Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two segments today. In moments, we'll hear from Corey Pine about his experiences living the life of a Silicon Valley entry-level drone. And then just after the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with a sex worker about new legal challenges to her profession. First, Silicon Valley. I don't watch much TV. I'm not morally opposed to it or anything, but there's usually something else I'd rather do. But one show I do regularly watch is the eponymously named series on HBO. It centers on a group of coders with poor social skills who live like grad students in a dumpy house that no doubt costs a ton of money because it's in the midst of some of the most expensive real estate in North America. They're constantly scheming to come up with a product that will make them rich, though right now they're anything but. There are some ancillary characters who have gotten rich, a few tech moguls and venture capitalists, or VCs. We use the abbreviation in the forthcoming interview without a formal introduction, I'm sorry to say. But mostly, they seem like dreadful people. If these are your role models, well, I'm reminded of Rilke's famous poem that ends with the line, "You must change your life." Turns out the show's image of life in the Valley is pretty faithful to the real thing. My first guest, Corey Pine, spent the better part of a year living among the tech industry's postulants, trying to cope with the hideously high cost of housing in San Francisco and its surroundings. He lived in windowless basements and other dumps, sometimes 20 to a bathroom. His finest accommodations were in a tent in Mountain View, though the quasi-outdoor lifestyle doesn't have the ring of a long-term strategy about it. And he spoke with techies and studied the culture and its often appalling politics. The result is a fine book, thoughtful and entertaining. Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley, just out from Metropolitan Books. This is not the celebratory material the disruptors like to circulate. It's a world of stress, failure, and fraud with a big helping of callous greed at the top. Aside from this book, Corey Pine writes regularly for The Baffler. He's a former staff writer for Willamette Week, and he also has written for Slate, Salon, Foreign Policy, The American Prospect, and the Columbia Journalism Review. He'll be doing several readings in the Bay Area in early May and elsewhere around the country as well. You can find the full schedule of the readings on his Twitter page, Corey Pine, Coreypein. I'll list the Bay Area readings after the interview. Here's Corey Pine. The HBO show Silicon Valley centers on a group of hackers and would-be tech moguls who live in this nondescript house all together in Silicon Valley. And judging from what you wrote, it's actually fairly faithful to life. There are a bunch of guys with poor social skills, barely getting by, living in group quarters, trying to strike it rich, right?
It was pretty faithful to my experience. I was surprised by that. I mean, I know Mike Judge worked in Silicon Valley before he went into the entertainment industry, so he had some context, but it was surprisingly up to date in terms of the barracks-like conditions and some of the hacker houses.
Yeah, and they were doing it in the Valley, but you were in San Francisco for a while, right?
Mostly San Francisco. I did spend some time in Mountain View.
Living in a tent, yes. Yeah. I want to get to the tent in a moment, but tell us about your experience of the housing market in San Francisco.
It's a nightmare. I mean, it's been a while since I lived in New York, but it surpassed anything I'd experienced in New York or London. While Airbnb has taken, thousands of units off the market, that's not that much in the bigger picture. The real factor is displacement from a bunch of recent, STEM graduates moving in and getting first jobs with $120,000 a year salaries and taking a reverse commute to the tech campuses and the suburbs.
And then what does that do for people who land in town trying to strike it rich, who don't have these connections, don't have the job yet?
My wife, after reading my book, put it to me like this. She said, it sounds like these work camps in Shenzhen or someplace like that where people come from the countryside. In the book, I call them internet okies. It forces them into really subpar living conditions. I mean, I stayed at an Airbnb that definitely would not have passed a code inspection. For instance, you had maybe 20 people crammed into a single-story house with a basement converted into rooms as well. People, living rooms screened off and people sleeping on cots in there, and no security. Many of my roommates in these situations were techies, but some were not. Some were, I remember a couple of culinary students who were, working night jobs across the bay, and they had not stayed anywhere more than 3 or 4 weeks at a time. They were just bouncing from one Airbnb or short-term rental to another. And that's a pretty common situation that is unacceptable, really, and illegal. But it happens.
It happens like crazy, right?
Yeah.
This is San Francisco today. It's this incredibly polarized and weird city now, right?
Yeah. You know, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and everybody said, oh, you love San Francisco. It's just that, but more so. And I think that might have been true if I'd gone to San Francisco 20 or 30 years ago. It's not the case today. It reminded me of Wall Street, actually, in terms of the barren social scene and the company.
You spent a lot of time going to networking events and such.
Yeah.
Describe what those are like. Who populates these things? Who sponsors them? And what goes on?
They're incredibly tedious. It's, you know, forced mingling and socializing by people who don't really want to socialize. The sponsors run the gamut, but most of them are companies that are just trying to attract attention. And so the way they do that is convert their venture capital runway into canapes and hors d'oeuvres and drinks, which they give away to all comers for the most part, and force their employees to attend and glad hand.
And this is also a way to get food and drink if you have no money.
Yes. You know, there's a character in the book who was a lovely guy who lived in the Tenderloin and would crash these things. I mean, I was using apps like Eventbrite and Meetup to just plan my days. Much of my reporting was fly-on-the-wall stuff, just showing up at whatever was happening that night. And there's a guy I ran into a few times who was doing the same thing, had no real reason to be there, except he knew that this was a ticket to free food and drink, and we had a good time. I really enjoyed talking to him a lot more than the people that were there for work reasons, because I'm afraid that a lot of techies coming up don't have a lot to talk about unless you're talking about their work directly. And, you know, the things I wanted to know about were not necessarily so much the apps that they were coding, how that was going, but what their day-to-day was like, what their aspirations were like, how they saw the world and their place in it.
And how do they see the world and their place in it?
They see themselves as something of a privileged class. You know, there's a quote in the book, it wasn't mine, I borrowed it from The Guardian. A reporter there had gone to one of the same places that I hung out, and somebody told him, we are the architects of the future, and there's still very much that view. These are technocrats on the make, and that's very much how they see themselves.
Even if they're living in a basement 20 to a bathroom?
Well, that's part of the work hard, play hard ideology that these kids are indoctrinated in. I mean, they see that as sort of necessary suffering and part of their eventual Horatio Alger story. Mark Zuckerberg had his dorm room, Steve Jobs had his garage, and the tech dorm is something that I imagine they think they'll be talking about someday after they strike it rich, which most of them won't.
Right. if 5% of them do, that'd be a high number.
You know, there was actually a Harvard, I think, business school study that looked at failure rates for startups. And when you honed in on tech startups, the failure rate was about 95%, depending how you defined it. Now, if you define it as not hitting targets, which for a venture-backed tech company is as good as failure, because it means you're not going to get another round and you're going to get acquired or just, you know, shut down gracefully, it is about 95%. One of the early criticisms I've heard from the book is, well, you don't talk about the winners. I say, well, who? Show me them. You know, where
well,
are they?
Heard of those people.
Yeah, and we've heard of them. Yeah, frankly, that story's been told 100 times.
Way too many times.
Right, to the point where it skews people's expectations about what kind of economy we have and what kind of economy Silicon Valley is designing for us.
Yeah, let's talk some about that. One of the striking things you point out is that when people are pitching their apps or whatever, it's mostly about marketing, right? Not technology. I mean,
100%.
It's all buzzwords and talk about that.
That's something I was surprised by. I really thought that the actual technology itself would play more of a role in terms of what sort of startups, apps get investment. Really has very little to do with it. The most important thing is, can VC analyst who's looking at maybe 100, 200 pitches a day, so 10 minutes on each, something like that, understand the idea and see a market for it and see how to sell it in that short amount of time.
Thus the shorthand, an Uber for X, right?
Yes, Uber for X. That's why all of these shorthands, everything's got to get boiled down into a really, really concise elevator pitch that usually, yes, takes something that people know has worked and made money and puts a new spin on it. to the point where there's even multiple online startup idea generators that will give you, you know, like Mad Lib version of a startup. And some of them are actually, I could see them flying. One of the largest venture capital incubators called Y Combinator even announced some years ago that they would begin funding startup teams that did not have ideas. And they said, we realized we were kind of doing it anyway because so many people after they got funding changed what they pivoted. So they changed what they were doing, which raises a question of, well, how do the winners get selected? If it's not your idea, if it's not the engineering, if it's not even necessarily the marketing, how are they picking these people? And, you know, the answer is, as you might expect, who you know, what your Ivy League credentials are, and how much you can BS your way through the peculiar sort of social mores of California culture.
I was also struck by how many of the successful names originate in various kinds of fraud and theft. Google, for example.
Yeah, Google started out by, I think the word was borrowing computer resources from Stanford. I think they were consuming at one point something like 60 or 70% of the network capacity on campus. Now, it was with the blessing of the faculty, but something sort of outside channels. So they were diverting resources as they also put it, begging, borrowing, and stealing their equipment from around campus. So, you know, it's part of the sort of outlaw mystique that these companies like to cultivate. But when you look at it, if you think about how Google actually works and the some of the functions we take for granted, like search, their search product involves making a total facsimile of every page they can crawl on the internet and essentially republishing it, right? I mean, that's how they develop this index that you search. So the whole company is based on arguably a copyright violation. Now, courts and politicians over the years have legitimized this conduct. But in much the same way as Uber and Airbnb, these are business models that would have been intolerable. When I looked at the companies that have been successful coming out of Silicon Valley, one of the common threads I saw was a blatant disregard for the law, any regulations that might get in your way. The idea is make as much money as fast as possible and then get politicians to legitimize your past conduct through campaign contributions or just by virtue of being a large successful company that can bring jobs to a district.
Of the few companies that are making large amounts of money in the field, I mean, there's just so much fakery and wishful thinking involved. But of the companies that are making money, like Facebook and Google, who are making real serious money, there's an awful lot of advertising scam too, right? Like,
huge amount. I mean, you know, I went to a conference that was focused on digital advertising, and the hot topic that year was ad fraud. And we're hearing more about this now by virtue of the Cambridge Analytica scandal and some of the mechanics people are beginning to understand about how the Facebook business model actually works in online ad sales. It's almost too technical and boring to get into on this program, but suffice to say the security experts analyzed it. Four ad agencies determined that there was something like $7 billion they could account for that was fraudulent in the online ad market,
which is like 15-20%. Fake clicks and things like that.
Fake clicks, click farms, where people in countries like Bangladesh are actually paid to sit around and click on ads all day, like a penny per click or a fraction of a penny, and bots. And, you know, some of that, they attribute it to organized crime. Whoever the ultimate fraudsters are, and I think it's quite a mix because it's so easy, is somewhat irrelevant to my analysis because the takeaway for Wall Street and regulators, Congress, and the public should be that recognition that that revenues of these companies, Google, Facebook, the big ones, are inflated by this fraud. They have actually no incentive to really crack down on it because then their numbers go down. And if you're looking at Facebook or Google, for instance, you have to ask, well, how do these companies actually grow from this point? I mean, they're pretty ubiquitous. Facebook has like more than a billion users. Are they going to get every person on the planet to use it? I mean, that's part of their strategy.
They're up to like, what, 1.5 billion, which is almost a quarter of the world's population.
Well, right. If you believe, I mean, you know, and who's really dug into these numbers?
Yeah.
I mean, how are these things audited? I mean, I think that if there were more investigative and regulatory resources devoting into how Silicon Valley accounting works, people would find that it works a lot like Hollywood accounting, and some of these giants would not look so giant anymore. And none of them can afford a slowdown. I mean, this leads to all kinds of social problems. I mean, abuse on Twitter has been a hot topic for a couple of years, right? A very hostile place, especially for, you know, women, minorities. Why has Twitter not solved this problem? Why haven't they kicked off the Nazis? Well, how far down do you think their user base would go if they actually solved the problem? They have no incentive to do that.
Yeah. It's funny, though, you know, they make money selling advertising based on user targeting. You're supposed to be able to target your interests and such. But if you look at the profiles they create of you, if you look at your Facebook profile, or what is that thing that Cambridge Analytica came out of, Apply Special Sauce or something, this guy who at Cambridge.
Their guru.
It's nonsensical. You know, it just bears, I looked at my own, it bears no resemblance to who I am.
Actually, it was pretty interesting. When the finger pointing started with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, their engineer went on, I think, CNBC or something like that. You know, a network that investors are paying attention to, and said, you know, the real issue here was that Facebook's profiles weren't that useful on their own. We had to sort of cobble together our own profiles based on what data of theirs that we could use. Now, that's a shot across the bow, because Facebook was saying, oh, they abused our platform, unconscionable. I mean, many companies are probably doing what Cambridge Analytica was doing. And their response was very clever, because it said, hey, actually, your core product doesn't work. Very clever response on their part.
Yeah, I mean, at one point I liked Sarah Palin because I wanted to get her updates. But, you know, anybody who drew a political conclusion out of that would have been very confused.
Right.
I'm speaking with Corey Pine, author of Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley, just out from Metropolitan Books. You write some about journalism in this world, in a world where upbeatness is sacred, optimism, and the reluctance to criticize or think critically. What happens to journalism that approaches too close to the Silicon Valley?
It turns into advertising. We could have avoided a lot of problems if we had better journalism in the tech industry over the past 20 years or so. Why did it take John Carreyrou, I might be mispronouncing his last name, but why did it take a Wall Street Journal reporter to bust Theranos wide open after it had gotten all this investment, all this praise, glowing profiles in The New Yorker, glowing praise in the tech press, and lots of prominent board members and investors? That case alone suggests a major failure on the part of the tech press. There's somebody quoted in the book who was at the Wall Street Journal back in the 90s when the dot-com boom was getting going, and he said, you got to understand, before the boom, the first big boom, the people that were writing about tech, you know, they reported to business editors, and business editors at Metro Dailies were basically former sports editors who were too drunk to really hack that anymore. So these were people who were basically just getting press releases from companies, rewriting them, and putting it out in the world. And, you know, over time, a standard of coziness develops that people who understand how press dynamics in a place like Washington, D.C. work would recognize. However, you know, having done political reporting myself, I would say that the industry relationship with the press in Silicon Valley is even more corrupt than anything I've seen in D.C. or Wall Street or typical business reporting. I mean, the press reps at companies, especially like Google, are used to getting their way. They have had active blacklists of unfriendly reporters for years, and they're not shy about letting you know if they think that you're going to write anything off script that not only will you not have their cooperation, they're going to bully your editor into having you reprimanded. I mean, I heard so many stories from tech reporters, who, some of whom were, you know, talented, well-meaning, dedicated journalists starting out in their careers, you know, and hoping to do well, about stories getting nixed or PR people calling and making sure that coverage was assigned to friendlier reporters as opposed to ones that might ask questions and do their jobs.
Well, it's always the story that that journalists want access, and if they're too hostile, they're not going to get access. But there's also the temptation of joining the club, right?
There is a pathway to wealth for journalists in Silicon Valley, as it does not exist in many other areas. I'm blanking on his name, but, you know, one of the wealthiest men in the world, a VC out of Sequoia Capital, started as a tech reporter and parlayed his access at Apple into a VC job, was lucky enough to invest in some major companies like Google, and now he's a multi-billionaire. For a tech reporter who's, like most journalists, underpaid, overworked, looking at their exit. Everybody in Silicon Valley is focused on an exit, right? For a lot of journalists are thinking, well, I can always go work, you know, if they're not that ambitious to think, well, I can go work at PR for one of these companies and easily triple my salary. If they're very ambitious, they might think, well, maybe I can play my connections and get my own VC fund going. Which, you know, when I used to cover like City Hall and cops and things like that, and it's just not possible. Not possible when you're doing that kind of reporting.
No, yeah, but your dream would not be to become a beat cop, really, if you're a reporter, right? It's like, well, though, I don't know, maybe so, who knows. Let's talk some about the politics of Silicon Valley. The last part of the book focuses on that. We know that you know, there's a very big libertarian streak among techie types, but there's also like a really nasty fascist streak too, isn't there?
Yeah, I sort of stumbled across that back in 2014 as sort of the genesis of the book. I wrote a piece for The Baffler called Mouth-Breathing Machiavellis of the Silicon Reich about a character named Mencius Moldbug, whose real name is Curtis Yarvin. He was a San Francisco software engineer who made a little pile of money in the first dot-com boom and went into early retirement and became a self-styled scholar and philosopher and had a blog which had a small but very influential following. And my original article teased out some connections between him and Peter Thiel, for instance, the Facebook board member, PayPal founder.
Who has that, who perfectly embodies that libertarian and authoritarian side.
Oh, yes. And has been extremely careful about walking a line of respectability. He, like many very wealthy people, is concerned about what other wealthy people think about him. So maybe wouldn't openly endorse some of the fascist writing that he has subsidized because he invested in Moldbug's startup, which has no purpose as far as I can see. And according to emails that came out in BuzzFeed last year, you know, they talk politics together, and Thiel considers this fascist blogger an advisor by his own account, political advisor, and recognize now that we're talking about someone who Donald Trump has relied on for advice and for consultation in terms of who he should appoint to various agencies and things like that. I mean, Thiel is pretty plugged into the Trump administration, or was. Yeah, there is a large fascist streak. I was one day, you know, doing some research in the Stanford Library, and this scene is described in the book, and riding my bicycle back to Mountain View, where I was staying. And
in a tent.
Yeah. Best accommodation in my Bay Area adventures, really, was the tent. Anyway, the road was blocked. I had to get... cop made me get off my bike, and I'm like, what's going on here? And, you know, I do a little research on my phone, and Geert Wilders was invited to speak, you know, at this major venue in the heart of Mountain View by the local Republican Party. And, you know, that is a bigger trend, right? We've seen the right writ large go in more of a fascist direction over the past few years, but I would argue that Silicon Valley played a really important role in that shift in terms of a sort of free speech absolutism and libertarian ideology that allowed fascist propaganda to spread and metastasize in a way that would not have happened
otherwise. Is this like the rank and file regular coders or further up
the
hierarchy?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, you've seen that with people like James Damore, you know, the fired Google engineer who wrote that misogynistic memo.
And misogyny is a big part of this.
I mean, I think misogyny is at the root of a lot of the fascist turn of tech culture. And, you know, it'd be hard to get into in this conversation without getting into pop psychology. But I do think it's at the core. I think that a lot of people, younger people especially, who arrived at neo-fascist or neo-reactionary or alt-right ideologies did so beginning with a red pill ideology or a pickup artistry culture. There's a lot of overlap there. With the bogus race science that gets promoted on these sites and some of the crazier ideas about how society ought to be governed in the future in the most efficient technocratic way possible, which, according to Thiel's buddy that I mentioned earlier, is through a kind of corporate monarchy.
Yeah, like dissolve the government and turn it over to Google.
That was one of the proposals by a Google engineer, funny enough. You know, kissing up to the boss. I've never seen it quite that extreme. No, there is a vision, and it's expressed and interpreted in different ways that would, I would say, is characteristic of the right side of the political spectrum in Silicon Valley, which is that governments ought to be essentially dissolved and people should have free choice in government, which would essentially mean taking your pick in a consumer fashion between any number of corporate fiefdoms. You literally become a citizen of Google or of Facebook or Amazon or what have you.
And what should be pointed out, these corporations are deeply undemocratic places. They're deeply authoritarian places. They're, the boss's word goes. And that means, you know, democracy, any pretense of it is out the window.
Yeah, I've heard it said. I mean, there was a piece in the Times by their tech columnist some months ago, and somebody asked me to respond to it, and I just thought it wasn't even worth my time. They were making the argument. Somebody did a survey of tech CEOs and said, look, they're all 90% of them are liberal, but that didn't account for their views on labor. And if
they're okay with transgender bathrooms,
but
don't raise the minimum wage.
No unions. They don't even want to recognize their employees as employees. Everything is...
That would be a commitment.
Right. Well, right. And, you know, there's all sorts of mumbo-jumbo explanations they have for why, their vision of a direct democracy where, everyone's Bitcoin holdings translate to their share of the vote would be better than what we have now. But when you actually see how these things work in practice, it's strongly authoritarian, no place for labor. And, you know, their tolerance for their progressivism on identity issues is there's a limit to it. Silicon Valley does have a certain level of diversity in that there are many East and South Asian engineers. Some companies are making an effort to hire more women, but does that really matter in the bigger picture? I mean, they're creating a society where our choices are I call it in the book the 50 cent economy, get rich or die trying.
Right.
I mean, this gig economy, sharing economy, it's gone through various buzzwords. The fundamentals of it are, as one union official that I interviewed put it to me, shifting all of the risks and costs of employment onto the worker. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, well, that's been the drift of politics for the last several decades. Like, that's retirement risk. You know, it's all on you.
But that's why tech is big. I mean, if you look at the fundamentals of the actual technology, I mean, look at the processor in your computer or your phone. It hasn't got, I mean, supposedly there's this thing called Moore's Law, which means that pretty soon we're going to have a technological singularity and we're going to merge with the computers because it's the processor speeds are growing exponentially. I mean, it seems like they've hit a bottleneck and you aren't actually seeing very significant innovation. What you are seeing is new ways to extract value from labor, new ways to commodify and financialize things that we are used to getting for free or are used to receiving as public assets. That's where the innovation is in Silicon Valley. It's not about tech.
Yeah, it's striking that, you know, the ideology of the late 90s tech boom was very exuberant. A lot of it was nonsense, but there was all this stuff about, you know, flatten hierarchies and lead to human understanding and better forms of work and self-expression and spontaneity and all this business. And now it's just about better ways to hail a cab or order lunch. I mean, the utopian quality seems largely gone.
Yeah, I think that is maybe, you know, we're in the hangover period. One of the questions that I've had through the course of reporting the book and even after writing it is this a bubble that's going to pop? You know, because you can explain some of the hyperbole and the enthusiasm from just easy money flowing around, right? I mean, I got a lot of free drinks and food there. There was still some easy money floating around. And I think that's gotten a little harder to find. But unfortunately, I think the grim reality is we might not have a bubble that pops like it did at the turn of the millennium. We might have a new order of economic relationships that these companies have succeeded in establishing in terms of, you know, the state pulling back from its responsibility to provide services, more of that work getting picked up by corporations, fewer legal protections for workers, less enforcement of existing labor laws. And I don't see any reason why they can't just carry on this way.
Yeah, this is the tech dystopia.
There are many places, and as far as, you know, we talked about the fraud a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure that we live in a country anymore where the exposure of fraud produces a consequence. Look at the presidency.
Yeah, Theranos.
Theranos, right?
I mean, she got slapped in the wrist.
Yeah, but the investors still walked away with money, right? I mean, she might be barred from running a company again and engaging in the medical market, but I think we probably haven't seen the last of Elizabeth Holmes.
Probably not.
Not
there
to be
are
a
second acts in American life.
Yeah.
Finally, has this experience on Silicon Valley's dark side changed the way you use these machines or relate to them?
It sure has. I was going to pull it out of my pocket. I use a dumb phone now, for one thing. I have very poor self-control, and I hated being constantly distracted by notifications. As part of my research, I learned how methodically and amorally, I would say, some of these companies manipulate people's emotions and try to create Pavlovian responses to apps and smartphones and all their products. So I try to limit how much I allow those things to distract me. I appreciate the effort that some people put into protecting their privacy and data. My view, and I'm pretty up on the technical stuff. My view is that it's a losing battle. To protect our privacy online, things like that, is not something that we're going to be able to do through, you know, some browser plugin that encrypts our communications. It's something we need government action. We need laws, regulatory framework to protect our data. You know, there need to be consequences for companies that are turning us into basically profiting off of our experiences, our thoughts. I mean, every time you type a search into Google, they're logging it and they're turning it into a part of a bigger behavioral profile and selling it to whoever. And that's the real thing about the real scandal in the Cambridge Analytica story is that these companies will sell our information to anybody. Any, the worst people in the world.
That's their business model.
If the mob wants a profile on you, they'll just sell it to them, right? I'm not sure there's a way out of this through individual action. I mean, personally, I do try to restrict, you know, how much time I spend staring at the smartphone, for instance. So, like I said, I've downgraded to a dumb phone. But to really solve the problem, I mean, we need politicians to understand that action needs to be taken to make some of these business models illegal, frankly. And, I'm supposed to be working on an op-ed about renationalizing the internet. I mean, I think that's the ultimate answer. So we need to develop a new set of computer networking protocols that solve some of the problems with copyright and privacy protection. And unlike last time, when we developed these protocols, they shouldn't be immediately privatized.
That was Corey Pine, author of Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley, just out from Metropolitan Books. He'll be making several appearances in the Bay Area at the beginning of May. On the 1st, he'll be at Book Passage in San Francisco. On May 2nd, he'll be at the Follett Store in the Stanford campus. And on the 3rd, Books, Inc. in Mountain View. You can find his full schedule and links to his website and podcast and his Twitter page. The handle is Corey Pine, CoreyPein. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of I Am a Scientist from Guided by Voices. Damn, that was almost a quarter century ago. Next, sex work. The other day, Trump signed two bills most commonly known by their abbreviations, FOSTA, the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, which emerged from the House, and a similar Senate bill, SESTA, the Stop Enabling Sex Trafficking Act. The Communications Decency Act, passed in 1996 during the Clinton administration, provided a very important exemption for both platforms like websites and for internet service providers, exempting them from liability should illegal things happen in their domains. A common way of putting it is that libraries bear no risks for the books that they hold in their collection, so neither should similar institutions in the electronic age. SESTA and FOSTA carve out an important exception to those protections in the name of stopping sex trafficking. Of course, no one wants people to be forced into sex work, or any kind of work for that matter. But the very high-profile and well-funded campaign against trafficking, as high-minded as it sounds, has been used as a cover for a war against all sex workers, which is an outrage. The lives of sex workers should be made easier and safer, not harder. But because of this new legislation, things are going seriously in the wrong direction. Here's a sex worker who wishes to remain totally anonymous to explain what it all means. These laws are presented by their supporters and sponsors as cracking down on sex trafficking, child and otherwise. That sounds like a noble goal, but what's wrong with it?
The sex trafficking movement, the anti-sex trafficking movement, for one thing, has millions of dollars that is funded into an entire rescue industry that purports to be in charge of rescuing these supposed tens and thousands of victims of sex trafficking. The problem is that there actually is no evidence that these plethora of sites have some kind of a conspiratorial network beneath them that are where sex trafficking is taking place. There was an investigation in the Backpage that led to the crafting of these laws, but all of the sites that consensual sex workers use have been affected and taken down by this. The problem with fighting sex trafficking, actual, you know, sex trafficking, is that when you take down these sites, it forces, not only consensual sex workers themselves into more dangerous work, such as working on the street or working without the ability to screen or verify clients, but the actual trafficking networks are forced more into the underground as well, making it harder to find trafficked victims. For instance, when the sites are down and there's no advertisements with photos and whatnot, you can't use facial recognition to search for trafficked victims. You can't, go through the websites and look for, say, your child, for example, who you suspect might have fallen victim into the hands of traffickers. While there's all these narratives in Hollywood films, in books, and all these narratives in American media about these huge networks of trafficking that take place, there's no actual, there hasn't been any scholarship and studies done on what the real statistics are. For instance, with migrant, the image of the trafficked migrant woman, feminist scholars talk about how nobody has actually gone out and spoken to these women and heard their narratives of whether or not they actually are trafficked. And so there's this kind of huge rescue, white savior industry and mentality that goes into building these narratives of rushing in to free these slaves of sex trafficking when there's very, very little studies and statistics and information in the background about what actually is going on, what websites are they, is this happening on, and is this really the way to save actual trafficked victims by shutting down these websites and then creating a scenario where trafficked victims are now sold on the streets? How do you find them?
Backpage has long been a particular target of the anti-trafficking lobby. What is the story of Backpage? Why did it attract such negative attention?
I don't actually know much about the history of Backpage myself. There's tons of sites that consensual sex workers use to advertise on and screen clients on. Backpage is just a site that is national and nationally used and has been around for a while. You know, it's totally possible that there was an investigation into Backpage at one point yielded that there was minors selling sex on Backpage. But to be clear, anyone under 18 is considered a victim of trafficking, even if there is no third party involved. So a minor who could be selling sex with their own agency would be considered a victim of trafficking. And studies have shown that the majority of minors that sell sex are actually not trafficked by a third party. They've run away from home or somehow are displaced, and that is their way of their means of finding food and shelter. So to be clear, anyone under 18 is considered a victim of trafficking, even if there isn't a third party involved.
Let's talk about how sex workers do their job these days. You don't find much in the way of street prostitution, at least I don't see it in New York very often. What has the internet done to the sex business?
I mean, for one thing, I don't use the term prostitution. I use the term sex work, because the term sex work, which was coined by a sex worker, Carol Lee, in the 1970s, puts the emphasis on the labor aspect rather than the moral standing of sex work. So I prefer to use the word sex work. You know, the effects of these websites means that people don't have to use the streets to do their jobs. It means actually that they are able to run their own businesses, that they get 100% of the profit because they aren't trafficked, which, you know, falling into the hands of pimps and traffickers is something that occurs when you're working on the streets. With the websites, sex workers can advertise on their own. They can set their own wages and their own rates, and they can avoid third-party pimps or traffickers. And they can also screen clients. They can see what clients have seen other sex workers. They can talk to other sex workers. They can stay in touch with other sex workers to make sure that clients are safe and aren't violent. So when these websites have gone down as a result of Sesta Fossa, and these are not websites that have been found guilty of any kind of, you know, letting traffickers onto the sites and stuff like this, or any kind of letting minors onto the sites. These are websites that are simply shut down because there's this suspicion of trafficking when there's consensual sex work actually happening. The effect of these sites getting shut down is that sex workers no longer are able to advertise, for one thing. So you have, you know, an entire sector, over 1 million people, out of work overnight. But also, they're not able to verify who their clients are. They're not able to talk to other sex workers. They're not able to share information that they need to be able to stay safe. So while the Sesta Fosta laws follow this ideology of kind of saving these victims from, you know, this horrible exploitation, what it does is that it forces an entire sector of sex workers, which is estimated well over 1 million in this country, into a situation where they can't work safely. So while it pretends to be concerned with violence against women, what it does is force women out of work and out of a means of work in which they can control their wages and get 100% of the profit into dangerous street work. And already within the sex worker community, there's reports that there's 15 sex workers who have gone missing since Backpage got shut down, and that 3 sex workers have been murdered since Backpage went down. And that's a result of not having websites and not having this ability to communicate and stay safe and actually check on who these clients are.
I'm speaking with a sex worker who must remain anonymous for many reasons. And this is, of course, no abstraction. You mentioned murders, but, you know, you just also find it nearly impossible to do your work now, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no ability to advertise. The sites are down. And then when you do come into contact with clients, we don't have the ability to see who they are anymore, to get references from other workers who've seen them, because we have no way of verifying that the other workers exist without being able to see their advertisements. In the sex work community, there's people who are losing their homes. There's people who can't feed their kids. There's people who are desperate and scared, not only, you know, scared of physical violence, but unable to work over and overnight. If you had any other sector of 1 million jobs lost overnight, people would really be questioning, you know, what's going on and saying, what can we do about this? But because it's sex workers who are extremely marginalized, who are looked down upon, who people have this, tend to project this idea that, you know, doing sex work is kind of the lowest of the low decision that a woman can make. It is not with her agency or empowerment. Because it's sex workers, nobody really cares. And so, yeah, it's very scary that people have lost their living overnight in the name of an anti-trafficking narrative and hysteria in the media.
I'm sure a lot of people who support this legislation would say, and this could be people on the political right, but also you could imagine some liberal feminists taking this similar line, that good, this is terrible work, people shouldn't be doing it, and it's illegal, so that's the point of this. They should be losing their jobs and getting out of work.
People see it as terrible work because the idea that, quote, women shouldn't sell their bodies, when we reduce what selling your body means for women down to sex, we reduce women to sex. All laborers, you know, all workers sell their bodies in one form or another. Even teachers, for example, or intellectual laborers, you know, they have to wake up at a certain time. They have to put their bodies in a certain space. Why is it that we see sex work as so different from other forms of labor? And I think that part of that is because historically, a lot of feminized labor, a lot of labor that women do, is seen as natural, or it's seen as meaningful suffering. It's not seen as real labor. For example, housework is not seen as labor that is deserving of a wage, et cetera, et cetera. It's just something that is natural and it's done. And so this idea that sex work somehow is morally degraded from other labor, even though, you know, sex workers, consensual sex workers, get 100% of our profits. Most other workers, a lot of their labor and the value of their labor goes to a boss, and that's completely exploited labor. But I think that we reduce women to the act of sex, and then we say when women have sex for money, women are selling their bodies, but women are much more than sex. And there's many ways in which people sell their bodies in exploitative ways in a capital economy.
Well, it's also, I guess, important to point out that not all sex workers are women. There's men and people who don't fall along the two classifications.
That is important to point out, but the reason that I'm really talking about feminized labor is because these narratives are based on misogyny. This bill is based on misogyny. This bill is not, Sesta Fosta is about regulating how feminized subjects, transgender and women and men as well, but how, you know, certain people are using their bodies and how their bodies factor into the economy, right? And so this bill is based on a misogynist narrative and history that is not different from wanting to regulate abortion. It's not different from other ways, other laws and regulations that are passed that seek to kind of control birth control, for example, that seek to control the way that specifically feminized bodies are working. And so, yes, there's sex workers who are transgender, there's sex workers who are men, but the ideology of bills like this come from a history of misogyny and a need to regulate certain bodies in the economy.
Of course, the sponsors of the bill, and as well as, you know, people who follow the tradition of Andrea Dworkin, would say that they're rescuing women from this kind of degradation. It's the opposite of misogyny. The true misogynists are the pimps and the promoters and the customers.
Right. I mean, for one thing, there's this really extreme co-optation of the Me Too movement. And a lot of the discourse around the bill, listen to survivors, these victims, et cetera, et cetera. There's no denying that sex trafficking exists. The problem is that when you apply that category to all workers and you have middle-class white liberal feminists determining what is exploitative work and what is, you know, morally degraded or exploited work for working-class women. Nobody is listening to sex workers in this narrative. And sex workers, consensual sex workers, don't want to be rescued. And consensual sex workers, numerically, there's many more than there are these trafficked victims. And so once again, the rescue industry that has millions of dollars flowing through it, all these NGOs, all these lobbying efforts, the rescue industry builds up these narratives that are not actually really based on people's stories. And quite frankly, it's a very white colonialist narrative that reminds me of the, you know, the beginning of the war on terror and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, of needing to go in and bomb people's infrastructure to save these degraded women of Islam without talking to the women.
And finally, a practical question. Are there ways to work around this, or are you guys been thrown for a loop here?
First and foremost, sex workers are trying to figure out how to survive and how to survive and stay safe in this moment, how to, you know, how to pay their rents, how to take care of their kids. Way before Sesta Fosta was passed, the sex worker community was, yelling and screaming and asking for people to call Congress and to oppose the bill, and nobody listened. And so now I think that the sex workers' rights movement has really moved into kind of harm reduction point, where people are trying to figure out, well, you know, how do I make a living, and how do we keep other workers safe? And so, I mean, a way to work around it, that's really hard to say when there's girls already dying and there's girls already going missing and there's people losing their homes and there's people who cannot pay their bills and there's people who cannot feed their kids. So, you know, I think that first and foremost, we need to focus on how are we going to keep these over 1 million consensual sex workers alive.
I was a sex worker who must remain anonymous because life as a sex worker is challenging enough already. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Sex Without Stress from the Au Pairs. Till next week, bye.
Stress.